Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hey, we're so happy you're here. Welcome back to the Money Tree Podcast. I'm Joe Saul-Sehy from Stacking Benjamins, and I'll introduce my partners here in just a second after our first half of the show, where we interview Karen Chan, who is affiliated with the Federal Reserve, and she's going to talk to us about Money Smart Week and basics in finance. But before that, if you've ever wondered if there were a way to capitalize on all that online chatter, the millions of investors on social media, your wait's over, because the Buzz Index uses the same artificial intelligence techniques that some of the world's most sophisticated hedge funds use, and you can make their edge your edge. The Buzz Index trades under ticker symbol BUZ, and it gives investors a portfolio of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. Check it out. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. Miranda.
Yeah, well, we're talking about science and data and using science and data. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health conscious people like runners, cyclists, strength trainers, vegans, and more. If you have a healthy habit that increases your wellness, you could save money on your life insurance policy. In fact, 56% of Health IQ customers save between 4 and 33% on their life insurance. Health IQ can save their customers up to 33% because physically active people, people who eat well, people who take care of themselves have a lower risk of heart disease, a lower risk of cancer, and a lower risk of diabetes. Life insurance companies calculate your policy rates based on your nearest age, not your actual age. And those rates increase as you get older. With Health IQ, they look at your actual age based on your wellness. So lock in the best possible rate today by getting a free quote. Head over to healthiq.com/moneytree. Again, that's healthiq.com/moneytree to see if you qualify to save money on your life insurance. And now let's get back to that science and data about our finances and talk about Money Smart Week. Joe?
And joining me on the show today, Karen Chan. Welcome to the show, Karen. Thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy you're here to help us celebrate the start of Money Smart Week next week. So let's help people get smart with their money. For people just starting out, my son and my daughter, Karen, just graduated from college. There's kids listening to this, maybe getting ready to graduate from high school. What are some of the places where people really step in it when they're first starting out?
Well, I think the two things that I would say people are most likely to make mistakes because of their ignorance. It's not because you're stupid. It's because you're ignorant. Yeah. You don't have experience and nobody told you. So this is a great chance for us to give some basic knowledge to use here. Everybody's always anxious to get their first credit card. It's not unusual for somebody to go out and say, oh, you know, goody, goody gumdrops, I'm 18 or I've graduated from college and I've got my first job. And so let's go get a credit card. And so to be sure they get one, they go out and apply for 4 or 5. Wrong strategy. Pick one card that you really want to have and apply for it. Preferably to start off with a store credit card, like a department store.
Oh.
As opposed to a major credit card. A standard Visa, MasterCard, American Express. Reason being, retail store cards are often a little easier to get, meaning that because you have no credit history yet at this point, you'll be a little more likely to get one of those cards. But the main thing here is to only apply for one, because as soon as you apply for a card, you're going to start building a credit history. And on your credit history, there are things that count for good points and there are things that subtract from your points. Too many applications for credit become bad points.
It sounds like what you're saying is if I go apply for 5 different credit cards, like in your analogy, everybody kind of panics because it looks like I'm desperate.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I never thought about the store credit card too. I think then you're probably less likely to use that credit that often because, you know, unless I'm shopping at Kohl's for everything, I'm not going to use it as much. Is that also part of the strategy that I maybe open it but stay away from it?
Actually, no. Up to this point, we've just been talking about what are you more likely to be able to get.
Gotcha. You know, okay.
As a new applicant for credit who has probably little or no credit history at all. And if you think like a lender, you'll realize that some person that you do not know comes and wants to borrow money from me. How do I decide whether to lend them money? The best indicator I can have is that they've borrowed money from somebody else and paid them back. Barring being able to have that kind of information, what are the other things? Yes, then it may boil down to the fact that you might like to have a $5,000 credit limit, but because I don't have any history on you, I'm not going to give you a $5,000 credit limit. I'm going to give you a $1,000 credit limit. And if you don't pay the balance every month, the interest rate I'm going to charge you is going to be higher than the rate I would charge somebody that I've got a good track record on.
Which is going to be my next question. I assume then that's the reason to do that early, so that you establish that credit history early in your life?
Yes. Having a credit history is going to help you in a lot of different ways. You know, initially, we thought of building a credit history really as only being relevant when you were getting a car loan, getting a mortgage, getting a personal line of credit at the bank, things like that. But now, your credit history impacts a lot of different things that you do on a regular basis. As a young person starting out, one of the things that you may be doing is trying to rent an apartment. What is your potential landlord going to do? They're probably going to pull your credit history. It will help if you have a credit history, meaning that there is some record that you've borrowed money and made payments on time. But it will be especially helpful if there are no negative pieces of information on that credit history. So no late payments, nothing that's gone to collections because you simply did not pay, not too many applications for credit. As you said earlier, that indicates to a lender, which a landlord in a sense is, it may make them think that you're getting overextended and maybe you won't be able to make the rent payments. Other situations that you may run into where your credit history is going to affect you is whether or not you can get a regular cell phone contract. They're going to check your credit history. When you apply for auto insurance, when you try to get auto insurance, maybe you're buying your first car, the majority of auto insurance policies will check your credit history as one of the factors they use to rate you and decide how much to charge you for the insurance.
That's a place people don't even expect it, Karen.
Precisely.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. That's the credit side of it. What about things like budgeting? You know, I never see people budget anymore, it seems like. How important is budgeting to your overall success?
Budgeting is actually critical, but particularly, okay, I think the standard advice would be that everybody should have a budget and should track their expenses all the time. And by the way, I do actually distinguish between tracking your expenses and having a budget. There are two pieces of a whole, but they're actually two separate pieces. There are folks out there who would say everybody should track their expenses all the time. Everybody should have a budget all the time. Well, that's sort of the ideal. But many of us, me included, just don't have the patience to do that. My philosophy in a lot of money management is not to strive for perfect, but maybe to be just a little better, you know, to do what's good enough instead of trying for the ultimate. And so budgeting and tracking expenses, my philosophy is there are times when it's critical. You know, I'll never tell somebody you have to do it all the time, but the times in life when it's critical are mainly when some sort of change has occurred. Well, as a young person, maybe moving out on your own for the first time, that's a major change. You really don't know how things are going to work. And so for the first several months, it's really critical that you have some sort of a plan of how you think you're going to spend your money, and then you track your expenses to see how close to the mark your plan, your budget actually is. One of the things that people get frustrated about is they'll set up some plan. I'm going to spend this many dollars on groceries. I'm going to spend this many dollars on transportation, so on and so forth. And halfway through the month or at the end of the month, they look back and realize that their spending did not match their budget. And their attitude is, it was a failure. No. A budget is a plan. It isn't expected to really be an exact representation of how you spend your money. It's a plan so that when something happens that doesn't fit the plan, it's a little red flag that tells you, oh my gosh, because it's Thanksgiving or Easter or whatever, I spent a lot more on groceries this month than I would normally. That means I better cut back somewhere else. Mm. And your budget is the tool that helps you do that.
And with that shift in mindset, instead of saying I'm wrong, now you're saying I can budget better in the future because it's information I've collected.
Exactly. Yes. And like I said, if you have no plan and something happens that wasn't really expected or isn't quite the norm, I use this analogy. If something happens, let's say you're at work and it's your coworker's birthday and everybody says, oh, let's take Joe out to lunch today. You say, sure, fine, I'll go. And of course, then you're buying your lunch as well as chipping in for Joe's. And suddenly you're $30 down compared to where you thought you were going to be. But if all your money is sitting in your wallet with no plan or, your credit card, whatever you're using, you just pay the $30 and go along your merry way and make no adjustments. But if you had a plan saying that I was going to spend this much for lunch at work this week or this month, and suddenly you're $30 over that, it gives you a way to judge how to make changes so that you stay within your overall budget.
I'm laughing because I think what you're saying is if I don't have a plan for my money, somebody else does.
Yeah, that's pretty much the way it works. Yes. There will always be somebody who wants your money, whether it's an advertiser, when you start having children, it's the kids. There'll be somebody who's always got an idea for something that's going to cost you money, and it's up to you to be the gatekeeper.
That's great. Let's talk about trimming that budget then, Karen, because I see people clip coupons and I think, okay, you save 30 cents right there. What are some real bang for your buck ways that people are able to trim the budget to save more money?
Well, the way that I like to think about trimming the budget is to actually think about expenses in three different categories. This may sound very old-fashioned, but it's something that I think is a very usable tool to help you look at where your money goes. And it's to think about each of your expenses and ask yourself, is this something that's pretty much the same all the time and I don't have a lot of control over it? That is a fixed expense. Think car loan payment. Think monthly cell phone payment. Think monthly rent payment. These are things that in order to change them, you've either got to change the contract, sell the car, pay off your lease on the apartment and move somewhere else. There are barriers to changing these amounts. So when you're looking at your spending, these are the things that you put down and pretty much say, I got to cover these. Doesn't matter what happened. These are fixed. Then you've got your flexible expenses. The ones that they may have to happen every month, but you have pretty much leeway in how much they are and when they happen. For example, clothing is perhaps the ultimate example of a flexible expense. If I need a new pair of slacks, I can go to the high-end section of the department store and I can spend $120, or I can go to the discount store and probably find something for $15. Or I can wear something out of my closet and put this purchase off for a few more weeks. Food is also a very flexible expense. And couponing, I know that there was a time period a few years ago when we had all these extreme examples of saving money with coupons. The fact of the matter is that those people are spending a lot of money. They may be buying things that they don't need. They may be buying the things that aren't the most healthy for them. To me, saving money on grocery shopping is really about reading the weekly ads, choosing a store that overall has low pricing, and being open to alternatives when you're in the store. If I'm standing in front of the pasta aisle and I usually buy brand A, but brand B is on sale today, then by golly, look at brand B. And if you were planning to have fajitas tonight and you're looking at a nice cut of beef to make that out of, and you realize that none of that beef is on sale today, but there's some ground chuck over here that is on sale and it's about half the price of what you were going to buy. Well, then let's have tacos.
Flexibility for the win.
Yes, flexibility for your flexible expenses, precisely. And then the third category of expenses are the ones that get us in trouble. They're the ones that don't happen every month. And these come in two flavors. One is the expense that's regular. It's just not monthly. And my best example of that is the registration for my car that only comes once a year. My water bill comes every other month, which drives me crazy because I can never remember which month it's coming. And then you've got, holiday expenses and things like that. Those are at least predictable. They're just not on a monthly schedule. And simply having a calendar where you've marked these can be really helpful, or a list of them that you look at once in a while. And of course, the others are the totally unexpected ones where suddenly you're hit with a $1,000 car repair, or the cat goes to the vet and, you know, it's $300. These are the things that we can't fully predict. So the goal is to either have enough saved up on hand to manage these things, or you're going to be going into debt. Those are really the two choices. Either have enough cash on hand saved up that you can cover these things, or you are going to go in debt, period. Mathematically, there's just no other choice.
Right.
And so that's really the challenge that we face is, let's cover these fixed expenses to start with, figure out how to do the flexible expenses, keeping within our monthly budget, and at the same time, leaving some money left each month for, one, the totally unexpected, and two, the things that we might have not have to pay this month, but a big thing that's coming up, let's say, in 2 months, we really won't be able to pay it out of 1 month's income, so we got to set some aside.
And I was going to ask about that, Karen, so I'm glad that you finished off there, is that so now I've freed up the budget and I've got some money saved. How do I get that money saved, keep it saved, right? Because like you said, money in your cash in your wallet, if I don't have a plan for it, somebody else will. How the heck do I get it out of my wallet in a systematic manner?
Well, I think first, before I fully answer that question, let me just say that we have a lot of different personalities. And one of the things to understand about yourself is, what are the ways that work for you to hang on to money? I have an older sister who, if there's cash in the wallet, that's not too big of a temptation. Cash sitting around the house is a zero temptation. She actually was her most successful at saving when she was simply throwing like a $5 or a $10 bill in the drawer anytime she thought about it. She saved a substantial amount. But if there's money in her checking account, it will go away.
Wow.
Now, that's not what you would normally expect, right?
Yeah,
that's not everybody. But because she understands that about herself, she knows that she needs to have a separate savings account and move the money into that separate savings account. And she even has hers at a different bank, so that there's one additional little barrier to her accessing that money. She can get it if she needs it, but it's not where she can just, while she's standing in a store, say, oh yeah, you know, I've got this much money in that account, I can buy this. Now, for most people, the easiest way to build savings is to do it in such a way that you never see the money to start with. I want to use this as an example. It's not the only way to do this, but this is one reason why, if you have an employer retirement plan at work, having money taken out of your paycheck and going into that plan works so well, because you never had the money to start with. Therefore, there's no temptation to use it or say things like, oh, I'll save what's left at the end of the month, which is generally a recipe for disaster, because there'll never be any left at the
right.
end of the month.
Your brain will always find something.
Yes. It's been said so many times that it sounds trite and it sounds useless, because we have heard it so many times, but it is actually a very helpful concept to say, I should pay myself first, meaning that the savings should come off the top immediately on payday rather than wait until the end. And so the 401k can do that. With many employers, you can actually have, if you're having auto deposit, you may be able to split that deposit between your checking account and your savings account. If you're someone like my sister, that it's helpful to have that in a separate account. That will work for you. And then people come up with all sorts of ways to make themselves save. I have friends who simply do the old, at the end of the day, my change goes into a bottle at home. And after 6 months, they take this bottle of change to the bank and are shocked to find that they've got, you know, a couple hundred dollars in here. So I think there are many different ways to do this. The point is to do something regularly, and particularly to do something where the money is siphoned off before you even see it. And Joe, if I may, I'm going to talk about one way of saving that is actually kind of controversial.
Sure. Oh, no, we love controversy here at the Money Tree.
I remember in most of my financial training, when we talked about taxes, and since this is tax season, it's probably a good time to talk about this. The idea was that you should only withhold as much as you really expect to owe. You should never let the government have the use of your money. You know, why let them get the interest on that money? I understand the thinking behind that, but I know a number of individuals who they intentionally have more withheld than is necessary for two reasons. One, because they're afraid of a nasty surprise on tax day. Most of us, if we end up with a tax bill of, say, $1,500, most people don't have $1,500 to pay it. And so we're avoiding that kind of catastrophe. But the other thing of it is, a lot of people use their withholding from their taxes as a form of forced savings, so that when they do come up to tax filing season and they do get a nice refund, they actually plan to use that very effectively. It might be how they're going to fund a family vacation that summer. It might be how they're going to pay for summer daycare when the kids are not in school and daycare expenses go through the roof. They actually make that a way to manage expenses that otherwise might have been very difficult.
What I'm thinking about, Karen, as you're talking, is the big thing I think for people starting out to learn, and you're proving this over and over, is that, you know, personal finance is very personal. And, you know, when you're talking earlier about debt and staying out of debt and money on hand and stuff like that, it's know yourself.
Yes. Yes. Because there are certain overarching principles.
Yeah.
But how you get there needs to fit how you work.
What are your favorite resources? Obviously, we have a great resource coming up here with Money Smart Week. And I want to talk about that in just a second. But what are some of your favorite resources for people to turn to get some financial education?
Depending on where you live, one excellent resource may be your cooperative extension service that is tied to the land grant university in every state. In some states, there may be more than one land grant university. For example, I live in Illinois. University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign is our land grant university. And because it's a land grant university, it has an arm called extension, which means public education. I worked for University of Illinois Extension for almost 20 years. What they do is public education out in the field, out in the communities. They are a research-based, non-commercial source of financial information. Now, some states have more financial education going on through their extension service than others, so that's why I say it kind of depends on where you live. But the value of getting information from the Cooperative Extension Service is that you know there's never a hidden agenda, and it's always research-based. And so it's among your most credible sources of information.
I love that. And I have to tell you, in the top 10 things I thought you might say, that wasn't one of them.
They're a very well-kept secret.
Well, but that's fantastic. I love it. That is cool. Let's talk just a little bit. You're involved with Money Smart Week. How did you first get involved, Karen, with Money Smart Week, which starts tomorrow?
I was involved in the very first Money Smart Week back in 2002.
Awesome.
When it was just a Chicago event. And it was because I was working for University of Illinois Extension at the time doing personal finance education. So Money Smart Week was just another opportunity to do what I did year round, but to do it in a week when we were getting media attention and the public was building an awareness about this.
That's really cool. And for people looking to get involved, how do they get involved with Money Smart Week this coming week? Because I know that now it's not just Chicago based, there are events all over the United States.
It really has become a nationwide thing, which I think is phenomenal. You want to go to a very simple website. Simple meaning the URL is simple, thank goodness.
Good.
It is moneysmartweek.org, moneysmartweek.org. The first thing you'll see is a map of the United States, and you click to find an event. Put in your zip code, and depending on if you're in a very densely populated area or whatever, you can choose to search for events 5 miles around you or 25 miles around you. Now, unfortunately, there may be places where you won't find something, but in most areas of the United States, you're going to find something. And going back to what I said about extension, that the reason that's such a great source is because it's research-based, it's non-commercial, and so forth. The reason that Money Smart Week is an excellent time for people to get financial information is this. This is an effort led by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. It was their brainchild. To present a program that's labeled a Money Smart Week program, you need to be a Money Smart Week partner. And to be a partner, you must agree that what you're going to present this week is non-commercial and it's free. So even if it's a banker, even if it's an insurance agent, even if it's a commission-based investment person, what they're presenting during Money Smart Week should not be a commercial. It should be education. You might voluntarily get in touch with the person, but they should not be even collecting your contact information. Okay. So it's a safe environment for you to go and learn about whatever you want to learn about and not have the concern that you have when you get the flyers in the mail saying, oh, come have this great dinner. And by the way, we'll be talking
right.
about this.
Right. I used to give those, by the way.
Did you?
Yeah, you're right. They're not free, but they still can be costly.
Yes.
Right. Yes. Good point. And that's so important to know because there's a lot of smart people that come out to teach people during Money Smart Week. And I've taken part a lot myself, and it's a fantastic opportunity. We'll have links, by the way, to all the Money Smart Week information in our show notes at moneytreepodcast.com. I got one more question for you, Karen, before we have to say goodbye. I'm running a little long, but there's a lot of people listening that might want to do what you do. Talk a little bit about what you do outside of Money Smart Week, because I find it pretty fascinating.
Well, I'm somewhat unique in the financial world in that I am a personal finance educator. All I do is provide educational information mainly to groups. I am a certified financial planner, but I do not practice. I do not have individual clients. And so I work with groups who want non-commercial financial information provided to their patrons or retirees or employees or whoever the case may be. So I talk about anything from managing your credit history and credit score, especially in this age of breaches, to investing and the best strategies for claiming Social Security benefits. But I'm strictly education.
That's really cool. And if somebody wants to get a hold of you for education, how do they do that?
My website is Karen Chan, C-H-A-N, KarenChanFinancialEd.com.
Awesome. And we'll also, if you're walking the dog or on your commute, we'll link to that also in our show notes. Thanks a ton for spending time with us, and happy Money Smart Week to you, Karen.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you for helping the Fed and me get the word out.
Thanks again to Karen Chan for hanging out with us. Hey, before we get to our second half of the program, Doug Goldstein, do you ever see all these people chatting about stocks and bonds and investments online?
You know, it's funny. I watch a lot of people talk about it, but frankly, I get a little cynical about it because I always say, oh, some other guy is coming up with a new proposal, and who knows if he even knows what he's talking about or why he's promoting a stock.
But have you ever seen this idea of the wisdom of the crowds? Like if you don't take one person, you take all of them and kind of aggregate what they're talking about, there might be something there.
Yeah, that's very different.
Yeah, if you've ever wondered about that, Doug, or anybody else listening, the Buzz Index uses some of the same artificial intelligence techniques that some of the world's biggest hedge funds does, doing exactly that to capitalize on all the online chatter, the millions of investors on social media. The Buzz Index trades as ticker symbol BUZ, and it gives investors a portfolio of securities that show the highest degree of positive investor sentiment online. No surveys, no guessing. They target the most mentioned large company U.S. stocks across the social media landscape, listening to everybody. The more active there's a conversation about a stock, the greater the reliability of the buzz. They take the most mentioned stocks and give them an insight score based on their proprietary analytics. And the 75 stocks with the most bullish score every month, the Buzz Index includes in their index. So invest in the wisdom of the crowd. Head to moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ for a link to the Buzz Index and more information. That's moneytreepodcast.com/BUZZ. Quick disclaimer, I use the Buzz Portfolio, my portfolio. Doesn't make it right for you, but need to tell everybody that, Miranda, before we tell them about what happens if you pass away and you might need some help for your family.
Yeah. So one of the basics of personal finance is life insurance to protect your family. You know, it's something that a lot of us don't think about and a lot of us don't take a lot of time to worry about, but it is something that's important. And I know that when I think about my son, I want to make sure that if, you know, I'm the primary breadwinner for him, I'm a single mom, and yes, we get child support, and yes, his dad would probably take care of him if I died. But the reality is I still make more than his father does. And I would like my son to have opportunities like college, extracurriculars, and just, you know, eating and being clothed. And so life insurance is a big part of that. And if you are looking for a way to save money on your life insurance, to get the best deal, to get the most bang for your buck, Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health conscious people. So you could save money on your life insurance policy just by engaging in healthy activities like regular exercise, eating well. Vegans get a special rate. So you can save up to 33% using the following methods. You can take a Health IQ quiz and scoring elite. You can also show your membership to a qualifying association or gym for more than 1 year. So go ahead and call Health IQ for some details on how these actions, these activities can help qualify you to up to 33% savings on your life insurance. So 56% of Health IQ's clients get exclusive special rates. Health IQ is the only company that has invested in gathering science and data to prove that health conscious people live longer. So it is the only place you can go to find the special rates you deserve on your life insurance. Even if you have a pre-existing condition, you can get these special rates. So head on over to healthiq.com/moneytree to find out if you qualify. Again, that's healthiq.com/moneytree to see if you qualify to save money on your life insurance.
Stop the press. Healthy people live longer.
I know, it's shocking.
Isn't that wild? Actually, that's not shocking, but the fact that there's a company out there that focuses on that is pretty interesting. But Miranda, how are you?
You know, I'm doing okay. The universe has been giving me some interesting signals, and we're gonna start some new things. So I'm excited, a little bit worried, and just kind of ready to go, I guess.
That's fantastic. Linda P. Jones, our friend from Be Wealthy and Smart. How's your health IQ?
Well, what happens if you're addicted to gummy bears? Like, do they ding your score?
I just couldn't tell them. Keep it on the DL.
Right. Okay. Well, that we'll just keep it a secret among us then.
I don't know. There's a spot on the forum for gummy bears.
Oh, or
that may not be a part of the quiz.
Okay. Well, that's my health secret. So.
Right. And guess what, Linda? Let's introduce the gummy bear on this podcast from Goldstein on Gelt. It is Mr. Doug Goldstein.
Well, I just wanted to tell you, I just came to do the show with you guys after topping my 10,000 steps for the day. That's my target every day. And thanks to my handy dandy Apple Watch, I get guilty. I get this feeling of guilt if I don't do it. And of course, I get this incredibly proud feeling when I'm like, hey, I'm going to be super healthy. I'm going to call those guys at Health IQ and they're going to be begging me to get insurance from them.
You're not one of those people that shakes your watch to make it simulate more steps that you really didn't do. Come on.
And I just put it on the hood of the car as I drive to work.
Well, let's dive into what Karen's talking about. I'm going to apologize here because you may hear from time to time a little drilling outside and there's nothing I could do about that. Welcome to podcasting. Karen, I love talking to her, guys, but Karen started out talking about credit and not applying to 50 different places, but still establishing credit early. When I asked her about pitfalls, that was number one. When you talk to people that are new to money, is that the first pitfall you tell beginners to avoid? Miranda, let's start with you. Is that your first pitfall?
So yeah, when I'm talking to noobs about money, actually the first pitfall I talk to them about is understanding their values and their priorities, I think, but it plays nicely into this idea of credit and using credit responsibly, right? Because I think a lot of the time, the reason why we get into so much trouble with credit, the reason why we spend is we're using it as an excuse to just buy without thinking, right? We think, oh, well, I can get, because we hear about this, right, in our little bubble of personal finance people, you know, use the credit cards to get the points. Use the credit card to build your good credit so you can get a house later, or you can get better rates on your car insurance, or you can get into the rental you want. I mean, we hear these things and we start using it as excuses to spend without taking a step back and thinking, okay, what are my true values? What are my true financial goals? And how is this going to help me? So I think credit fits nicely into that. But I think the first pitfall is that we don't think about our money and we don't think about what we want it to do for us. and we don't think about our actual values and how our money plays into that. And then everything else just kind of goes downhill from there. So when I'm talking about money to newcomers, when I'm talking about money with my son, the first thing we talk about is what really matters to you. And, you know, how does money help you accomplish that? And how can money hold you back from that? A lot of it goes into, well, if you're not thinking about it and you're not thinking about, you know, how you're spending or how you're saving or however it is what you're doing with your money fits into your values and what matters to you, that's when you run into trouble.
Conscious spending is what you're talking about, I think.
Sure. Yeah. Let's throw a buzzword on it.
That's my whole goal. Yeah. You talk for 4 minutes and I'll say it in 10 seconds.
that's really kidding. How it works. Yes. I can be verbose.
Yeah. But Linda, so Miranda says consciousness with your spending, right? And Karen says the pitfalls of credit. You're talking to somebody who's new. Is it one of those two or something else?
Well, I love what Miranda said. And my version, I guess, is called spending priorities. So I identify five areas that you really want to use your money for. So it could be, you know, saving up for a trip or saving up for something special to buy. But beyond that, I think if you're going back to the very beginning, I would take a step before Karen talked about applying for credit cards. And I'd say the step before that, if you're brand new to money, you're a very young person, one of the very first things you have to do is pay your bills on time. I mean, that is job one, because that's going to enable you to get credit. So being very aware of when your bills are due, getting them paid a couple days ahead of time is going to be very helpful so that you have established a good credit record so that when you do apply for credit, you look great and you'll get the card no problem. So I would just say back it up a step and make sure that whatever, even if you're living at home, whatever bills that you have regularly coming in, whether it's, you know, for your phone or technology or Wi-Fi or whatever it might be under your name, just make sure that you're getting that paid on time.
I love these. I think this is so great for people new to finance. Doug, you're somebody working with new people, I'm sure, from time to time, people that are new with money. What do you see people do that wrecks things from the beginning?
You know, the biggest surprise I get is when I talk to people who are making some money, and then I mention, you know, you got to put some aside for savings, or you got to get into the matching of your company's retirement plan, or some sort of system that allows them to save in an IRA, something like that. And they go, yeah, I just don't think I can put aside the money this year. And I'm thinking, this is the number one lesson of investing. Compound interest is what it's all about. Get your money working for you so you don't have to work for your money for the rest of your life. And it surprises me to this day that the world of financial planning has not been able to indoctrinate the public to realize that if you're not actually putting away money every month and building up your savings by not spending it on fun things, but putting it into some sort of investment program, then you're never really going to make it in the long term.
What is it about that, Doug? Is it that we're programmed, I mean, just as people to think about our next meal and the very next thing, we're not really programmed to think about the long term? We got to reprogram ourselves to do that? What do you think that is?
I'm going to guess it's that people are very, very easily distracted by, to say the least, just, you know, advertising and people telling them other places they can spend their money, like on cars and TVs and food. And it's so enticing to spend your money in these other places that you just don't really feel like saving it. It's very hard to get the joy of saving money that you're not going to actually touch for decades. And of course, when the market's going down, you feel like, you know, why did I even bother saving it if all that happens is I invest it and I lose it? You know, I may as well have just spent it today and enjoyed the money today. And I think that's the mindset that people have, instead of realizing that long-term investors tend to do pretty well if they're careful and they follow all the great advice that they get from people like us, then they'll probably do okay. But they have to be willing to put aside the money for literally for decades. And the only way to do it is to start today.
But assuming that you agree with Doug, Miranda, how do we change that mindset? I mean, how do we, because I don't know, I don't even kind of agree with them. I really agree with them. I think people do have that mindset, but how do you make that shift?
Yeah. So it goes back to kind of what I was saying earlier, a little bit of what Linda was talking about with her priorities. Too often we see money as the end goal, right? Oh, I need more money. Money is the end goal. I need more money. Rather than doing what Doug had talked about, which was, hey, get your money to work for you. So this mind shift is like money is my tool, rather than money is my end goal because I'm behind all the time or I need more money or whatever it is. money is the tool, and making that mind shift to saying, okay, so money is my means to an end. And then saying, well, what do I want my money to do for me? How can money help me accomplish my goals? And I think once you start looking at it in those terms and saying, okay, I don't actually want money, right? I don't really want money. I don't care if I have piles of money. What I want, what Linda was talking about with her priorities, what I want is to travel. What I want is to help my son pay for college. What I want is to be comfortable and retire, you know, well, I, you know, whatever retirement is. But what I want is to be comfortable in the future. What I want is to be able to, when I lose three agency clients to in-house hires, be able to explore some other business opportunities for 4 to 6 months before I don't have any money anymore. So really look at what you want and then say, okay, how does money help me accomplish that? And how can investing and saving help me reach my goals? And I think looking at money as a tool is one of the first big mind shifts you have to make.
And I just want to echo both Miranda and Doug, but add that we're in such a consumer economy. Everywhere you turn, there's an ad to buy something. And we're brainwashed into thinking that we're saving money when we buy something on sale, that we're not actually spending money, but we're saving so much money. And so this whole consumer mindset starts at a young age where kids just want to buy and want to own stuff and want to have the toys and want to have whatever it is that's the latest thing. I notice, and I did this myself when I was young, it was, you know, you couldn't wait to own this, you couldn't wait to own that. And it was all about the stuff and then, you know, getting the house and then decorating the house and then all of the stuff. And then you get to a certain age and you're like, oh my gosh, I have so much stuff. I don't want any more stuff. And then you go the reverse way and you just want experiences and, you know, good health and things like that. And so your money priorities completely change. But from a young age, we are indoctrinated into this spending, spending, spending. And I think Miranda said it, where you're just wanting to, you know, spend. And that's just the way we're brought up.
Yep. So then, Linda, does it mean more open conversations about money? Does it mean us each somehow figuring out to look inward? Like, where do we begin to change the way the dominoes are falling?
Well, it's exactly what you and Karen were talking about. It's really financial education, because we're not getting the message that Doug was talking about, which is to get our money working harder for us. You know, I just did a podcast about what are people using their income tax refund for? And there were five things that they're using for. Some of them were, you know, very good, like paying down debt and saving money. But nobody put something like investing, like, I want to, you know, buy an ETF, or I want to invest some money, or I want to buy a stock, or I want to, you know, buy a mutual fund. Nobody put that. And nobody put, I want to start a business, which are two big money engines that people can use to grow and compound wealth. So we're not teaching people to even consider these things. And it's not even in their thinking. And so it comes back to financial education, which people aren't getting in school. And fortunately, now we have the internet and blogs and things like that, and podcasts, of course, where people can come and get an education now. It's so important.
You know, one of the things that I often talk about when I'm trying to push this concept of separating the idea that what Miranda was saying, you need to accumulate more and more money in order so you can buy more and more stuff to impress people that you probably don't like anyway, is I actually spend a lot of time when I do the financial plans for clients talking to them about the importance of charity. We can talk about the whole religious side of it, but from a practice, which of course I fully agree and I think is a great idea, but from learning about money, and you know, for parents who want to teach their kids about it and people who want to teach themselves about it, if you start giving away money, all of a sudden the money itself is not the value. You say, what? You really begin to realize that money has an impact. It can help to feed people, it can help sick people, it can help to educate people. It really locks in this idea that Miranda was talking about, that money is not for its own sake, but it's for a goal. And if you can encourage people, and you know, if you want to actually become better at doing this, I would say that maybe the number one thing to do is just to start giving it away, right? Give away 5, 10, 15, 20% of what you earn. Do that, not forever, but let's say for a couple of decades, and see how that changes your outlook on money. And I'm pretty certain that it's going to make you, A, much richer, because just my experience has been that people who do this actually do tend to do much better. And if it doesn't make you financially richer, it'll certainly make you emotionally and spiritually richer, because you realize that the money is not what it's all about. It's about what the money can really do.
It's interesting, Doug, to your point, I've seen some studies lately pointing to people that are more involved in their community, people more involved with giving to their community, are people that generally have more wealth. And it is, you know, and I don't know that that's causation, right? But there certainly is some correlation there. Let's shift gears for a second and talk about budgeting, because Karen draws a great line between tracking your expenses and budgeting. But when it comes to budgeting, to quote Larry the Cable Guy, you know, he talks about get her done. Miranda, how do you get her done when it comes to your budget?
So it's really funny that you talk about budgeting with me, because you know how much I hate budgets. But
that's why I went to you first, because you still get it done. I mean, you still have a pulse on your money. And how do you do that?
Right. Yeah. So I like to think of it as a spending plan, because it feels proactive to me. It's probably the same thing. But basically what I do is I say, well, what are my priorities? What do I want my money to accomplish? So I make sure those things are automatically taken care of first. Retirement account contributions, emergency fund contributions, 529 contributions, charitable contributions. Those are automated, by the way. I love that Doug mentioned that. And I have those automatically taken out every month, charitable contributions, without thinking about it, because it's one of my values and priorities. Bills like the insurance, the rent, and then I have the groceries that I've got a set amount aside for. So basically all of those really important things, the travel fund, all of that stuff, it comes out first. It's a planned for first. And then basically I just spend the rest of it till it's gone. Basically my plan is make sure that the priorities are covered, make sure those things are taken care of, and then it doesn't matter what else I'm doing with the money, as long as the things that matter the most are covered.
Almost like what Doug says, if you start with your goal and you cover the goal, then there you are.
Yeah. Or like what Karen said, which was that budgeting is the perfection. If you are a spreadsheet person and you love budgets, more power to you. That's awesome. But what I've found is the vast majority of people aren't like that and don't want that, because they feel like budgets are very restrictive. They want to go off them as soon as they've been on them. And they just, you know, they do everything to sort of just fall off the budget as soon as they're put on one, because it's usually not their idea to be on one. So what I tell people is, beyond the spending priorities that I've already talked about, which are usually five things that you're going to prioritize that you want to spend your money on, and be very mindful, as you said, Joe, about where you're spending your money, making sure it's in those areas. But beyond that, I think the concept of opportunity cost is super important. And we don't hear that talked about very often, but it's really a philosophy that I've lived by for most of my life. And I know Warren Buffett lives by it. Not that I'm anything like Warren Buffett, but just kind of saying that it's interesting that, you know, he lives in the same house that he's always lived in, because he didn't want to spend more money, because he realized there was an opportunity cost to that money. And that is that whatever we decide to spend money on, there's an opportunity cost where we could have invested it and made money on it. And being very conscious about what are our choices about where we spend our money, because every place we put it, you know, if you're buying very expensive sports equipment that you don't use that sits in the garage, or very expensive shoes that you don't wear and sit in your closet, those are perhaps things that you could have used the money differently. You could have used that money to invest and compound for you and grow wealth for you. So being really aware of opportunity cost, I think, is something you can do in addition to, or kind of as an extension of budgeting.
Doug, you're all about opportunity cost. I can hear you cheering while Linda's talking.
Yeah, I think it's very important. I also think that we just need to define our terms real clearly, because when we talk about a budget is something which I understand is not so pleasant to do, because it's really planning for the future. You might say, I'm going to spend $1,000 on music lessons for my kid this year, and I'm going to be a vegan so I can get that good insurance. I'm going to spend $800 for that. That frankly gets a little bit tiresome, because you have to go through everything and figure out how much you're going to spend. That's what a budget looks like. In fact, the US budget we saw was something like 10,000 pages. That was been terribly boring. But what I think is even more important than laying it out in advance is just keeping track of what happened. This is actually not as painful as it sounds for those of you who aren't real big budget lovers. But I think that if you're just willing to, you know, every time you buy something, keep the receipt or use one of the many, many apps like Quicken out there. And just, you buy something, you write it down. It has all these bells and whistles, but the most important one is to just look at the pie chart and see how much money you have been spending in any one area. And just that knowledge is going to make you much, much better at handling your money, because you look back and you say, wow, I spent $100,000 this year, but I only earned $90,000. I must have a problem. And it's so much easier then to make some decisions when you see what you're actually doing. And although I guess ideally everyone should make a budget and plan out what he's going to spend for the whole year, I accept the fact that's not going to happen. But really, everyone could keep track of ongoing spending and then just sort of make dynamic decisions, which is, you know, that's much easier and certainly more fun.
Guys, we're running out of time, but I asked Karen, and as you heard, I got a real surprising answer, which I loved, about her favorite resource. Without going into detail about why you like it, just one resource for new people in the world of finance that you really like. Doug, what do you think?
I'm going to go for one of the most simple ones, which is I like to look up investments on Yahoo Finance because it allows you very easily to get much more in depth than just looking at the change in the price of the stock, let's say, which I think people should look not at so much. But you really get more information there.
Linda, how about you?
One of my favorites is MarketWatch.com. I just like their articles, and they are usually something that on my stock market app on my phone will tell us, you know, what's going on in the market, what economic reports are coming in. I just like to get the up-to-date news and really get the pulse on what's happening.
I like both of those. Miranda, what do you think?
I actually really enjoy reading books about money and investing, like Oblivious Investing by Mike Piper. And then I also really like The Four Pillars of Investing by William Bernstein. And I also really like books like A Random Walk Down Wall Street. So I really like reading books. And so that's kind of where I go to get my ideas.
Thanks for sticking with one. I appreciate it.
I'm so sorry. One is books. Books is the umbrella. It covers everything. I can list books to, you know, books.
That's fantastic. And you know what? There's one book that I really like. My favorite book, I won't mention, but I think my favorite place to start is probably Your Money or Your Life by Vicky Robin. I feel like a lot of the stuff that we've talked about is encompassed in that book. If you have a philosophy first, then everything kind of flows from that philosophy. And I believe that you're trading money for time, like we talked about a lot here. And then you see why people do what they do. So good stuff. Let's talk about what's going on where you guys live. Dougie Fresh, what's going on? What's going on at Goldstein & Gelt?
Well, at Goldstein & Gelt, the mother company, of course, is Profile Investments. And I have now broken into the 21st century because we actually put up a Facebook page for Profile Investment Services, which was pretty exciting because we've had our website forever to help people who live outside the United States handle their U.S. investments. But now hopefully this new thing, you know, Facebook is going to help people learn even more.
Only, Linda, if someday Facebook would take off, it might be something.
Yeah. Well, on Be Wealthy and Smart, we're talking about 7 things to do with your tax refund, the podcast I referenced earlier. So check that out and see where people are using their tax refunds and where you might want to consider using your tax refund to really build wealth. How about you, Joe? What's going on over at Stacking Benjamins?
Well, I am talking to Jordan Harbinger. People might know him from The Art of Charm, but he had a serious breakup with his company, and bad things happen all the time. And there's times when you need to rely on your network of people, which Jordan is needed to do. And Jordan's a guy that you may know with The Art of Charm, built a big network of people and really has had to rely on it now. So we talk about that. We talk about when bad things happen and building a network to make sure that when it does come down the pike that you're able to get back up on your feet again. Miranda, how about you? How about at Planting Money Seeds or Adulting?
Over at Planting Money Seeds, we're actually going to take a look at what you need to do when you lose like a third of your income immediately. So we're going to take a look at my current situation and, you know, how you can deal with that, how to figure out what things to cut out, and then also how you can use it as a jumping off point to explore new opportunities.
Awesome. And that's going to do it for us this week. Thanks, everybody, for listening. And Miranda, you've got it. I'm going to bounce it right back to you.
Awesome. Remember to subscribe to the Money Tree Investing Podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, Stitcher, and everywhere fine podcasts are sold. Also, check us out at moneytreepodcast.com for more tools and resources and for our entire archives. So make sure you check that out. And remember, no one will take care of your money as well as you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.